The communist government in Cuba is loosening its grip on the country's economy. That's allowed thousands of small private businesses to spring up. It's really a new frontier for budding capitalists, and competition is fierce. And yet, advertising is still tightly restricted. And so entrepreneurs have to build their reputations in other ways, excelling in customer service, maybe it's decor, maybe better pricing. Nick Miroff has the story from Havana.
New snack bars and food stalls are all over Havana, but there aren't many that look like Tio Tito or Uncle Tito. The first thing you notice is the uniformed employees scrambling to serve up Hawaiian pizzas and fruit drinks as music videos play on a monitor behind the counter. The napkins and the to-go containers carry the Tio Tito company logo, and there's even a slick website, tio-tito.com, which is hosted abroad. That red and gold color scheme is no coincidence either, said proprietor and would-be Cuban fast food king Ivan Garcia. If those colors can work for McDonald's, he says, they might just work for him. Those are the colors that stimulate the appetite, Garcia said. I didn't make that up. It's what the research shows. Garcia's business is only one of two startup snack stands to make it in his Havana neighborhood. Six others have already gone under since last fall when President Raul Castro let more Cubans go into business for themselves. These days, it's no longer enough to hang a sign outside and sell sandwiches and coffee out the front door. Ismael Bello, another Havana entrepreneur, said the city's got too many vendors trying to sell the same things, so he's trying something different. With a new copy machine brought in from abroad, Bello and his family have started a printing and copy service called Havana, with an attractive, freshly painted storefront. He's competing directly with the Cuban government, setting prices at half what they are in state-owned copy shops. In 5 years, we could be a pretty big company, Bello said. Next month, we'll have our own website, and if we keep adding products and services, we can grow, he said. It's not clear how big Cuban authorities will let these new businesses get as they try to build their brands and open new locations. The government's political messages and propaganda must now compete with more and more commercial signage. But advertising is still essentially banned. So Cubans like Janet Alvarez have found other ways to stand out. Her baseball-themed snack bar, The Perfect Play, is quickly becoming famous among fans of Havana's beloved team, the Industriales, attracting crowds to her converted garage. Everything on the menu is named for something in the game, including a few rather unappetizing-sounding dishes like the dead ball and the squeeze play. But after toiling for years in drab state-run restaurants, Alvarez said it's exhilarating to be making her own business decisions. She even used the F-word to describe it.
If a customer orders a sandwich, you have the freedom to say, sure, I'll make it however you want it.
That kind of choice is something of a novel concept in a country where nearly everyone still gets an identical government food ration. And the have-it-your-way ethos isn't the only formula being copied here. One new Havana establishment is calling itself Burger Ray, with Ray meaning king in Spanish. For now, with a U.S. embargo still firmly in place and no Whoppers to compete with, the market is wide open. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
And speaking of big problems for the president, more and more economists in this country are talking about the possibility of a double-dip recession. Lakshman Achuthan, the managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, famously predicted the 2008 collapse. And then, last summer, he was ahead of the curve again in predicting the end of the recession. But today? Well, Achuthan says the odds of a return to recession are more and more likely.
People are getting worried again. And when you look at the forward-looking indicators, they're pointing to continued slowing ahead. And when our growth is already so weak, that means we are skating on very thin ice. The risk of recession in front of us, of a new recession, is quite high. And the jury remains out as to whether or not we're going to go into a recession. We don't have enough information to say it definitively, but I suspect we will have that information by Thanksgiving to know one way or another.
Here's what I wonder. A lot of economists and pundits are talking about a double-dip recession, right?
Yeah.
Going back into recession. But but as you know, for many people in this country, it doesn't really feel like we ever left the recession anyway.
Correct.
So what happens if we go into double-dip recession? How will things change substantially for a vast segment of the American population that is suffering anyway?
As unbelievable as it may sound, they are going to suffer more. they are in a depression. That is a depression for that cohort. And it poses massive problems for policymakers because a new recession automatically increases all of these expenditures out of the public sector while at the same time dramatically decreasing all their revenue. So there's even less ability to help the people who are hurting the most.
Now, some economists are arguing that right now we're just in a period of slow growth, not that different from the early 1980s, and that there may be some light, I'm not going to say at the end of the tunnel, but maybe just slightly over the bend in the hill. What do you make of that?
I don't have any evidence to support that kind of view.
You have no good news for us.
I'm afraid, and no, in the near term, I don't at all. The best news I can give you is that cycles do turn, but there's going to be a lot of pain in between. And this is very different than the early 1980s. The issues that ail the U.S. economy and the jobs market today are not things that result from nearby events. What we're living through and dealing with now has been building for decades. If you look at the data, you see that the pace of expansion has been stair-stepping down ever since the 1970s on all counts, on production, how much can we produce, how many jobs can we create, how much money do we make, how much do we sell. These are all trending down. The pace of expansion has been getting weaker and weaker for decades. It's not something that is new. So those who were expecting we should have a vigorous recovery had no right to do so. Rather, we're likely to see more frequent recessions than anyone is used to for the next 5 or 10 years.
Sobering news from Lakshman Achitan. He's the managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, and he joined me from New York. Lakshman, let's bring you back on. We have something good to tell us.
Check back in a couple of months, and maybe we avoid a recession.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
This week, the U.S. government's annual poverty and income report showed poverty increasing and household income dropping last year. But it was this piece of data from the report that really struck us. The earnings of male workers, right in the middle of the income ladder, are lower today, adjusted for inflation, than they were in 1973, almost 40 years ago. We wondered how that could be and asked NPR's John Idstey to find out.
It's right there in Table A5 of the report. In 1973, the median male worker earned just over $49,000 when measured in today's dollars, while last year, that worker, right in the middle, made about $1,500 less. Given that the output of the economy has more than doubled since 1973, and the productivity of workers has risen steadily, how is that possible? MIT economics professor Frank Levy says U.S. blue-collar workers had two things going for them between World War II and the 1970s.
One was that you really had a very strong job market for blue-collar labor.
That's partly because European countries and Japan were still rebuilding their manufacturing capacity destroyed during the war. Also, a lot of technology that has since replaced labor hadn't come online yet.
And so that meant that there were a lot of jobs in manufacturing and other related occupations for blue-collar labor.
The other thing that median American male worker had going for him back then, says Levy, was a set of institutions and societal norms that came out of the Great Depression and the New Deal that ensured wages would grow for most people as productivity grew.
So there were kind of conventions about getting cost of living wages, unions were part of it, and even the government getting involved implicitly in wage and price decisions was part of it.
President Nixon imposing wage and price controls in 1971, for instance. But after the food and oil price spikes of the 1970s, a decade in which the consumer price index rose a whopping 100%, the idea of wages rising in lockstep with the cost of living was abandoned.
And so what you got was much more of a minute-to-minute free market calibration of what wages were like.
Add to that global competition and technological innovation that eliminated U.S. manufacturing jobs, and we ended up with a surplus of blue-collar workers, so companies didn't have to raise wages to attract and keep them. Some analysts have suggested that wages have stagnated because workers are being compensated with costly health care benefits now. But Levy says that's offset by the loss of pension benefits, so factoring in fringe benefits doesn't change the trend. One big problem is that today's median American male worker has the same level of education as his counterpart in 1973. Just a high school diploma, no college. So he's not well prepared to compete for better jobs.
Educational progress sort of atrophied.
That's University of Wisconsin economist Tim Smeeting.
So in other words, we have not been graduating people from college as fast as we should have.
In fact, just over 30% of men attend college today. Women attend and graduate college at significantly higher rates, and their median earnings, while still lower than men's, have been rising along with productivity growth in the past decades. And over the last 20 years, even men who have college degrees haven't seen their wages reflect the growth in productivity. It's only men with advanced degrees who've kept up and, in fact, done very well. Meanwhile, our global competitors are raising the education levels of their workers. If America doesn't figure out how to raise the skill levels of its workforce, the future could continue to be bleak for those in the middle, says Professor Smeeting.
I'm afraid we have a lost generation out there of young people who aren't well prepared, who can't find work, and they're never going to realize the American dream.
If the fundamental American dream is that each generation does better than the previous one, that hasn't been happening for men in the middle of the U.S. income ladder for decades. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.